This is Sending Signals, a show about music and creativity. I'm your host, Matt Royal. Welcome to the show. Our guests this week, guitarist Steve Craddock and Scott Milligan, the brains behind Kitten Pyramid. Steve Craddock is the lead guitarist in British band Ocean Colour Scene. The band reached their commercial peak in the mid-90s with their second album Mosley Shores, reaching number two on the UK album chart, eventually spending 92 weeks on the chart, and the follow-up, Marching Already, going straight in at number one. The band were not a favourite of music critics, but were a formative band for me. I was 12 years old when Mosley Shores came out, and a mix of energetic, electric riffs and more melodic moments really worked for me. The first big concert I went to was Ocean Colour Scene at Braintree Arena when I was 14. The Mosley Shores Guitar Tab book helped me learn to play guitar. As the years went on, I'll be honest, I didn't maintain my interest in the band, but I had this connection to them that I can't shake, so I'm really pleased Steve agreed to come on the show. Steve Craddock is also a frequent guitarist for Paul Weller and has appeared on nearly all his studio albums, as well as being Paul's go-to touring guitarist. As if that wasn't enough, since 2014, Steve has also played lead guitar for The Specials. He's just reissued his second solo album on vinyl and digital. Yes, he also makes those. It's called Peace City West. With a bit of perspective, he was unhappy with the original release. He felt it needed a new mix, and the interludes previously featured have been removed. There's some really nice stuff on there, and you'll hear some clips from it as we go through the interview.
You've got an Aston mic there.
I have. Yeah, right. Aston Spirit.
Yeah.
Do you use them?
I've got a couple. I've loaned them to a friend, actually. A singer called Jasmine Kiddle. I lent it to her for a bit.
Yeah. How are you, mate?
I'm good, thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, how are you?
I'm all right. Yeah. You're down in Devon, aren't you? Which part?
Near Totnes.
Okay. How long you lived there?
I've been here about 14 years, maybe, in Devon. Yeah. And I've been in this house for 6 years or something.
Were you still sort of Solihull, Birmingham before that? Or did you live somewhere else in between?
On and off, I went to Brighton for a year.
Yeah.
And then back to, where was I living in Birmingham? Harborne, Edgbaston.
Yeah. Did you get back to Birmingham much?
No, not unless I'm playing, really.
Are your family still there?
My dad lives in Leicester and has done for many years. So yeah. I don't have family in Birmingham anymore. So there's,
Is that Chris, your dad, that used to manage you?
Yeah.
Yeah. Does he still work in the industry, or is he retired now?
No, he retired quite a long time ago. What is he, 78 now?
Right. Does he still come and see you?
Yeah.
That's cool. Are you doing the Weller tour that's just been pushed back?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, which I think is in November, isn't it? November time, December.
So I'm in Southend-on-Sea, so I live about 2 minutes from Eclipse Pavilion. So you've been through there a couple of times. So I've seen you with Weller a couple of times, just 2 minutes down the road. So
yeah, great. I was there last time with The Specials, I think.
Oh yeah, they've been a couple of times, yeah.
There's a great chippy just down the road, isn't
there? Oh yeah, yeah, I know one you mean, yeah. How did you survive like the Paul Weller cull, kind of when once he sort of sacked the band and he kind of spread out in so many different directions, and it's been amazing for his career, but how have you stayed in the fold, do you think?
I don't know, you'd have to ask him. But yeah, he was kind of bored by his direction, and I don't think Steve and Damon were enjoying the touring that much, if I'm honest. And I think his plans were to have a year out, but kind of 2 weeks into that year out, he was phoning me up and he said, come down to the studio, I've got a few ideas. And So I went down there, and it was for 22 Dreams, and the first track that we did was Have You Made Up Your Mind. It was quite a great session, really. I turned up, and by 3 o'clock the next morning, we finished the track. I'd played drums on it. He played the bass. We both played guitar. And so it was finished and finalized in a day, really, day and a night. And I think that must have been a good, you know, a good sort of turning stick to him, really. And then we carried on. He carried on doing 22 Dreams, which I was there for most of that.
That album was a real turning point, I think, in a stat, like, as if he hadn't done enough already, but like, I think he was in danger of getting just sort of diminishing returns from if he continued doing what he had done. And then that album just was like, he just suddenly tapped into something in himself, didn't he? And that really felt like a turning point for like the next stage of his career, you know?
Well, yeah. I mean, in hindsight, that's kind of, by bringing, I guess, that group to an end, he needed that reinvention. And it's sort of funny, I think it took most of a year to record that 22 Dreams. And you could feel that in all the music, all the different flavours and Night Lights and Light Nights starting and ending it. It's it's quite all-encompassing, isn't it, that album?
It's a really great album, yeah.
It's very colourful, I think. Like the mad instrumental bits, the spoken word bits, it's very eclectic.
Yeah.
Which, I guess people say that was the start of his, what's the word, is it?
Purple patch? Phase? Renaissance? I don't know. Pick one.
Yeah, come, it's a purple patch. What? Why?
So Ocean Colour Scene was probably the first, I think it was the first big gig I went to. I was 14 and I saw you at Braintree Arena on the Marching Already tour.
Wow, yeah.
It was fantastic, yeah.
Isn't it equestrian centre?
Yes, it is, it is. That's right, it is, yeah. Do you remember the gig then?
Yeah, I do.
Wow. Because I remember you opened, you had the sort of curtain drop and you opened with the first three songs on Marching Already. And then I remember the encore, Simon come on and did Foxy's by himself, which was great. And then I think P.P. Arnold was there and you did It's a Beautiful Thing. And then you finished with Song of a Baker, which in my like young naivety, I didn't know it was a Faces song. And so I taped you playing at Glastonbury off the radio and you'd covered it there. And I assumed it was like a song from like the next like OCS right. album. And then it like wasn't on Marching Already. And then you introduced it as a Small Faces song, and it was Song of Bacon. That was how I discovered it was a Faces. I'm like really ashamed of that now, but when you're young, you don't.
How it goes. That's how we all learn about music, isn't it? You know, through the Jam, which kind of was whatever they were, right? I heard of Curtis Mayfield for the song Move On Up. I heard of the Shy Lights, James Brown. You know, it directs you there if it's all working,
yeah,
it sort of inspires you, and you know, it's all. That's the difference between wearing your influences on your sleeve, right? And well, it's not even about that. It's just, you know, by doing covers, it turns people onto other things, doesn't it?
I wonder. I was going to ask you about this. I was trying to find a tactful way to ask you. Did you ever, were there discussions about how plainly your influences were on your sleeve? Because I feel like critically, that's probably one of the things why Ocean Colour Scene weren't well received from like a critical point of view. The fact that like it was so clear where your influences were from. Like, did you have discussions about that, or were you just doing what you wanted to do and not caring?
Of course not. We did everything naturally, and it was guitar, bass, and drums and vocals.
Yeah.
It was traditional in the way that we would have a middle eight, an outro, an intro, verses and choruses. But you tell me one of our songs that sounds like somebody else. And I know we're retro and I don't ever try to hide it, but is there a certain song that sounds like another band that you could say?
I wasn't picking. I mean, I hear, you know, that.
No, but if you can, I'm just interested. If you could say that song sounds like that, then I'd be interested to hear it.
Yeah. You know, I didn't have an example in mind.
But I also think the whole critical thing, I think that, journalists didn't like us because we weren't their band. Journalists like it because they get in early with bands and they champion them in the press. And we kind of made it through the fans liking our music. So we weren't kind of in the pocket of journalists.
Yeah.
And I don't think they liked that. So they made the obvious, you know, disparaging comments, which, you know, we're guilty of as well. We are a bit traditional, but we never professed to be, you know, so were the Lars, so were the Stone Roses.
Were you bothered at the time by the, all that stuff?
I think we probably was, yeah. But, I mean, how derivative are Oasis? They're even more derivative than Ocean Colour Scene.
You were very much a people's band, I think, weren't you?
No, that's something that they would use against us as well, the people's band, you know, right. The band musicians. It was always used in a disparaging flurry, I think, wasn't it?
I kind of learnt to play guitar from like the Mosley Shaw's tab book, you know. I mean, I guess I'd already started playing like, chord songbooks and things, but like I bought the Mosley Shaw's guitar tab book, and that was like my first kind of real foray into trying to play anything resembling lead guitar, you know, and it was...
Great.
Yeah, it was so, like, I've got a lot of formative experiences from those, particularly from Mosley and Marching Already, you know, and yeah, like, it's very, there's a lot of sort of formative experiences tied up in that, you know.
That's great.
And I wondered, like, when you play with Weller, do you get any, because I know, you know, you've got formative experiences with Weller as a fan. Do you ever try and nudge for set lists in certain ways? Are you ever like trying to nag him to play Pity Poor Alfie or something, or like?
Not really. At times, if I fancy playing a tune, then I feel welcome. I feel like I'm welcome to suggest it, and it's either yes or no, isn't it?
Yeah.
But we managed to play, which I've always wanted to do, and in hindsight, probably wasn't a great idea. I've always wanted to play Going Underground, which we did once for a Virgin Radio thing.
Yeah.
And we were in the room where we used to rehearse. I forget where it was now. But we did, and there's a version of that floating around somewhere, which doesn't sound too bad. But, you know, Paul's, he says that he's got to feel right. He's got to be able to sing it, you know, without, yeah, as the age that he's at. So, but I can ask, and we discuss sets. But yeah, he usually knows better than anyone else, because he's got the, you know, he's not only is he the boss of it all, he knows what's right, you know, he's been doing it long enough to know, hasn't he?
Yeah. You're reissuing Peace City West. So you've remixed it and you've dropped the interludes and things. What was the idea behind revisiting that now?
Well, I just heard that it was a 10-year anniversary. This is last year sometime, and I went back and listened to it, and it was just difficult to listen to. The sound of it was, it wasn't well mixed. I think at the time my head was trying to just make this really underground album sometimes that was difficult to listen to. And,
it worked.
But it doesn't, you know, in hindsight, it doesn't make for a good album.
Yeah.
I think it kind of worked against the listening of the album, and it had never been released on vinyl. So those two markers were where I set my stall out, I guess. So I remixed it, first of all, and was really happy with the way it sounded. And all of the the interludes just weren't needed. It was just nonsense, I thought. Yeah. And The album, I don't know if you've listened to it, the remix version, if you've got a copy.
I've heard a few songs. I've not heard it all yet, but I've heard a few songs, yeah.
Okay. It just makes sense, you know, the flow of it makes sense as an album. And I'm also pleased that it's coming out on vinyl and it's repackaged, it's got a different cover and everything. But more just to get it as a record, you know, I don't even know why I didn't release it on vinyl the first time around.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Yeah, I mean, it's weird to me that you were going for, yeah, this sort of messed up sounding record, because it's quite an upbeat, you know, it's your wife doing backing vocals on the tracks, is it?
She does, yeah.
She sounds lovely on it. And, yeah, can you tell me about Kites Rise Up Against the Wind? Because that's a That's a powerful song.
It was originally when I was recording Kundalini Target at Black Barn Studios. The engineer there, Charles Reese, had this instrumental track called Acid Folk, which Paul plays the recorder. Hannah Weller, or Hannah Andrews as she was then, was doing sort of R's. And Charles did the drums, bass and acoustics on it. And I always thought it was an amazing piece of music and nothing was ever done with it. So I asked if I could have it and I wrote the song over it. And the title actually comes from a guy called Andrew Davitt, who we call Davo, who ended up, funnily enough, being a keyboard tech for Paul. And he's a Scouser, and he's full of, you know, like a lot of Scousers, full of these beautiful ways of talking and rhyming words. And he was just talking, he was just going, oh, it's like, you know what I mean, lad? It's like when kites flies against the wind, lad. If you have evenings with a lot of Liverpudlian people, you can come away with a notebook, a notepad full of things, you know, titles or lines or... So it's one of them, really. I thought kites rise up against their wind. They do, don't they?
Yeah.
So it came from that. And it's, I guess the song is about just imagination, really.
Do you have a favourite on the album?
A favourite. I really like a song called The Pleasure Seekers. Chorus isn't particularly great, but it's pounding. I like the feel. I love the drums on it, and I really love the verses. And I like the way it sounds as a record. I think Last Days of the Old World is still even more an important record than when it was written.
Yeah, yeah, that feels relevant, doesn't it?
Even though, I mean, that sounds retro, doesn't it? I get that, but it is what it is, you know.
Yeah,
I really like "Lay Down Your Weary Burden," the song where Paul wrote. As a poem, he gave me a couple of poems.
Okay.
And says, do what you want with it, really. And I think the melody in that is really good. I think that's a great tune.
What's it like trying to promote your solo stuff nowadays? Does it feel like an uphill struggle?
No, because I'm not expecting... I think anything would be an uphill struggle if you're expecting too much, do you know what I mean? Firstly, I'm really proud of the record, so whatever happens after that is a bonus, you know. And I think that it's worth, if people give me time to promote it, then I would gladly do that because I'm proud of it.
Yeah, I guess it's trying to like hang on to that feeling that you, or that realization that you can't control what happens to an album once it's out there. You can only control the bit up to that, I guess, you know.
Yeah, of course. And I think that things that, you know, I've noticed that things grow over time, you know. People, it's not all that instant, you know, and people pick up on certain things. And it takes, what I like is that it happens through friends, you know, over years as well. And then you'll notice that certain bits become people's favourites. And it takes them years to get to that point, which, by me, is fine by me. It's, you know, whatever the outcome is all good. Staring at the same moon on the other side of the planet. I can hear your heartstrings that drum through the night. You play the cards at home, tempting me to you. I had taken this, now I'm breaking through to you. Finally found my way back home. Do you
ever an album either with Ocean Colour Scene or solo, anything you've worked on really that you feel is really overlooked?
Overlooked?
Or underrated?
I think we, the last EP we did with Ocean Colour Scene, it was a four-track EP.
2018, and, yeah.
Yeah, 2018. Because I think there's four really good songs on it. And it sold badly and no one really talks about it. But so I think that's been overlooked.
What's the status of Ocean Colour Scene at the moment?
Well, we're going out on tour in December.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we've had a bit of a rocky year, to be honest with you.
In what way?
Just kind of business and lack of communication. It's been probably, yeah, it's just been negative, but I think that's all been wiped up and sorted. And we're looking forward to going out on the road in December. Because, you know, we've got, whatever happens with albums and records, we've got an amazing fan base, people who come and see us, I think really cherish the songs and love the band. And I think that's really amazing that after 30 years, we've got that.
Yeah. Is there like a theme for the tour or is it a bit of everything? Have you got something in mind for it?
Theme, I just think we should knock it with all of the classics, you know.
Yeah.
If we've got classics, that's a bit arrogant. But, you know, play the singles and then make the set really as, I don't know at the moment, it's a few months away.
Yeah.
But, you know, try and be the best we can be at that time.
All right. It was nice to sort of meet you.
And listen, I hope you're okay with your OCD and all that. And just keep your chin up. You'll battle through it. You'll get through it.
Thanks, man.
Nice to meet you as well. And I'll see you at the gig.
All right. Bye.
All right. Bye, man. See you, mate.
If you're enjoying the show, please, please, please do any of the following. Follow me on Instagram at Sending Signals Podcast or on Twitter at Signals Podcast. There's also a Facebook page for the show if you feel like tracking it down. Nice reviews and star ratings on the Apple Podcasts platform are really appreciated. And if you're new to the show, please subscribe and look through the ever-expanding back catalogue of episodes. It all helps. Thanks so much for your support. Scott Milligan is the brains behind Kitten Pyramid, a loose collective who make a kind of prog pop music. Not a million miles away from bands like Field Music perhaps, but with a strong sense of the surreal. When touring the first album, Uh-Oh, the band played a series of shows in psychiatric wards, which was fitting as that album's dedicated to Scott's uncle who had lived with serious mental health problems. Kitten Pyramid are back with a new album called Koozie, and Scott took me through it track by track. You'll hear clips from the songs as we go too. Koozie is a triumph over absurdity, funny, sad and bizarre. And I had a great time talking to Scott about it. He's a really good guy, and I hope you enjoy this.
What were you looking to? Wow, what the hell was I thinking? Doing this again? Because everyone looks the same, you know. But you do, don't you? I don't know, it must be, maybe, I don't know what it is. But you think I'll do it anyway.
Certain people just must, yeah, there's certain people are just driven to be creative and it doesn't matter whether you make money from it or not.
And, totally, and well, I don't.
Yeah, and you just, same here. And you think, oh, like another project that's got nowhere.
Yeah.
Like what is the point in doing this? But then you just can't help yourself.
But yes, I agree. But I think because I like doing it, I you must do too, you know.
Yeah.
You do it because you love it. It's incredibly powerful love, the desire to do something. And the power of that is pretty, you can't really get in the way of that, I don't think. It's just at what cost? It's just at what cost?
Yeah.
That's the only thing.
Yeah.
You know.
Are you related to Spike Milligan?
No.
Would you like to be?
Yeah, I suppose so. Yeah, I'd be pretty cool. I mean, I do like my own dad, so I wouldn't want to say...
Well, not necessarily dad. He could be grandfather or uncle.
He could be granddad, couldn't he? Yeah. That's true. I think I read a book about him, and there was some really cool thing going on. I might get the period. It was on the 60s, and there was him and a bunch of other writer/comedian/whatevers, creatives, and they formed this cooperative, and Spike Milligan was quite high up in that cooperative. So basically, the idea was that if you're going through tough times and you're not getting booked for films or whatever else, this cooperative would look after you. Huh. And but then similarly, if you're doing really well, you would contribute to the cooperative.
Yeah.
And at the time, I think I was reading up on Quakers and how the cooperatives used to be, and thinking what an idyllic life that would have been. You know, what a great maybe naive, but what a great way to live your life. You know, if you're a business person, especially, you know, sharing the wealth and like Cadbury's, the Quakers had they built like Cadbury, Bourneville is just streets that they built for their staff. And, huh. and I just liked all of that. I liked the idea of the cooperatives, and I found out about Scott Spike Milligan and read about him and the behind, not just his comedy, but like him as a person and how driven he was. And I thought, nobody can spell my name or pronounce my name correctly. And I didn't want, because I was 2013, so I was in my mid-30s, and I hadn't had a single review. Then I've done a podcast. I was completely off the radar. And I thought, if I get a good review, just one in a reputable newspaper or magazine, and spell my surname wrong, I'm going to be absolutely gutted. So I thought, I'll just change my name and change it to Milligan.
Oh, really?
Yeah, rationale. Yeah, yeah. I'm not by Deadpool or anything like that, but for my art hat, if you like, I'm Milligan, and on the other side I'm Marson. That's my real name. And I think if you googled Scott Marson, you see this bloke in a suit talking about, you know, cosmeceuticals and the benefits of Juvederm Ultra or something, and you go, what, this is even more bizarre than his musical life, what the hell. So I think distancing them, despite not making any money on the creative side at all, I thought I need to separate them. And you're the only person that's actually asked that as well. And I think it was quite a conscious thing that I did. And nobody's really, the only person that ever noticed was Tom Robinson when I went on tour with him. And the first day of meeting him, he went, are you Scott Milligan or are you Scott Marson? Because he'd scratched the surface a little bit. And I went, oh, I'm Marson. That's the boring guy that makes money.
I think if you change your name to Sting, like I might have clocked that, like, that wasn't your real name, but Scott Milligan could be your name. Why would I doubt that? That is your name.
And it's SM, and when I write my signature, it could be Scott Marson, could be Scott Milligan. So I've tried to make my life as easy as possible, really.
So it starts with a title track, Koozie, which comes from a word, jacuzzi.
Correct.
Which comes from a story which has been widely touted in your promotional materials about your producer's jacuzzi in Spain that had 36,000 bees inside. Now, firstly, who counted the bees?
It was a calculation that the bee master...
Is that a job?
Predicted. Yeah, bee master. Yeah, there's a lot of them in Spain. And they said that basically in each hive there's usually on average 6,000 bees, and they'd all coexisted inside this jacuzzi, six separate hives. So they calculated that there was approximately 36,000 bees in the jacuzzi. And when he told me the story, and we were sat near it in Spain having some lunch when we went to go and see them, and I went, and there's just certain times people say something. I've got quite an acute radar or antenna for great titles, whether it's for a band title or a song or whatever else. And he went, and of course I got 36,000 bees in a jacuzzi. And I went, you know, no, I didn't see the right. You won't forget that one. It's a beauty. So yeah, the title, I thought, well, I'll use that, but I didn't know what for. And then I wrote the song. And it was "Oh Baby," but he didn't say jacuzzi. He just said "Oh Baby." I just kept repeating to myself, saying "No Baby," and I wasn't particularly enamoured with the creativity level on that one. So I was struggling a bit, and I was getting near to the time when I wanted to record it. And I knew I was going to record it because I had a strong feeling that would be not necessarily a title track, but it was a strong one. It was a single, And I think I was sat with him and I went, you know what, I could probably write this, your story into this track, because I felt like it was at the point where Koozie was written last and I played it to Nick just on an acoustic. I hadn't recorded it. And then we recorded it together, and that's how we want to work in the future. So I'm always trying to kind of sew in bits of Nick in there as much as possible. And I just felt like that was such a great story and very surreal. The idea of all of the bees just following this man with the queen in a box up to the mountains just seemed like a very beautiful thing to occur between two very alien, you know, the family in the villa, and then these bees coexisting and one being led by the other. So I just thought it's great inspiration for the song. For our song, and went from there. Really, actually, where this photo that I'm sat in front of is the quad studio at Rockfield. Underneath there is like a massive ledge. I'm trying to get the thing, but there's a ledge there. Okay. And it's long, and it's where, as you can see on the settees, it's where people just sit around waiting for the engineer to do something or being asked to do something or whatever else. So there's a lot of sitting around looking up, and when you look up, there's loads of graffiti, like the pillars at Abbey Road.
Right.
There's all the bands just doodling on there. And I thought I hadn't written Kit and Pyramid, so I'd started drawing it. And when I finished writing Kit and Pyramid, underneath it said Koozie in massive letters. And I thought, that's a cool word. How do I fit that in? And then the jacuzzi and the koozie, everything all kind of locked together.
Wow.
And that's the thing about it, though. That's the thing about creating stuff, is if you don't... Somebody said to me, do you storyboard your videos? And I went, no. No, I can't think of anything more contrived. I know you have to if you've got a big budget and you're on a time scale and there's loads of people waiting, but it's just me and a drone or my phone or whatever else. So I can do what I like, and there's no cost attributed to it. So why on earth would you storyboard it? You can have some ideas, like I want a town scene or a bee scene or whatever. But that's the thing with music, is you don't, you know, the blissful release of any financial pressure means you can just act on your instincts and be creative for yourself, not for anybody else. Because, you know, ideally, in an ideal situation, you do what you like and then you find other people that are in a similar vein. And I think David Bowie said that. He says, don't ever write for other people, write for yourself. Which sounds like really self-indulgent, but I don't think it is, because unless you're really odd, there's going to be other like-minded people out there. And if you can simply connect with them, then everybody's happy, aren't they?
And then if you don't like it, how can you expect anyone else to?
Yeah. And I've spoken to people that have had record deals or have record deals and have been successful. They never give me any positive or interesting stories on the back of it. It's usually awful. It's like, you know, the label didn't do enough work, or they weren't really interested, or by my third album, I just took the money and I just had to get the album done. I mean, what on earth? Yeah. You've got that opportunity to be paid to create, and you just want to get it over and done with. What the hell?
Sorry to harp on about the bees, but where exactly were they? When you say they were in the jacuzzi, were they like in the pipes?
They weren't swimming.
No, they were like
on the liners. They're inside. If you pulled the sides off,
yeah,
and there was a depth to it, and each compartment had a beehive in it.
Okay, all right.
Ask me anything else you want. I might be able to give you more detail on the jacuzzi. I don't know whether I have anything else though. I know it was very frightening. A lot of people got stung. I know they had to corner off a road to let the bees pass, which must have been very strange, because it was a black cloud.
Right. Yeah, if you've got any schematics of the house or a jacuzzi, I'd love to see. Everything's jumpable. From bees to frogs.
To frogs. Track bees to frogs. Not consciously. I seem to talk a lot about food and getting naked as well, which isn't conscious either. So I do notice patterns when I'm writing, and it's like I'll just throw in. I mean, I've written one that's going on to album three, and it's just I punctuate the end of every verse with the word biscuits. So why am I always talking about food? You know, I'm not obsessed by food, but it's just I think there's the way words drop and connect. You're a songwriter, you know what I mean? It stuff fits really yeah. well. But with Leggy Friends is about me being really miffed with the rest of my band not being able to go on tour with me to do the Tom Robinson tour.
Right.
Because we spent all this time recording and we got loads of great press. We got a tour with Tom Robinson, and it was his first tour in 20 years. So it was a real honor and privilege to be asked. And 90% of them said, I can't have time off work. And I was so upset about it. Because I thought, well, what were we all doing this all for? Didn't you believe we would ever do anything? What is this?
Yeah.
You know? So I wrote the lyrics basically saying that the way the lyrics are said is like, if you know I could fly, I cut the wings to feed the pigs. It's like basically saying, whatever I do, it kind of gets snipped in some way, and I find that really disappointing. So Leggy Friends is me saying people that just scarper when you need them. So it's quite a dark and negative subject matter, but you know, it's a happy song on the surface.
But no hard feelings.
None. No. I still keep in touch with them, and yeah. Chris Baldwin, who's still in there, he's going to be recorded with me on album three. Yeah. It was really disappointing because we'd worked for 5 years,
yeah.
and everything was going on this beautiful trajectory. And I thought we were a great band as well. I mean, we sounded phenomenal. We played so much. We recorded the Otto album in like 2 days live. You know, it took me 7 years to do this one on my own with the Leisure Society, but we weren't a touring band, so. Everything was done, you know, layer by layer. So what I was really disappointed. I think they were too, because they wanted time off as well.
Course.
It wasn't an excuse. It was just, I was disappointed overall with the thing.
Yeah. How many songs are the Leisure Society on? Are they on the whole record?
They are on 7 songs, I believe. The weekend is mine.
So 7 Day Duvet, track 3.
Yeah, that's the oldest song in the that I've recorded. It's back in sort of 7, maybe longer. It was when Kitten Pyramid first started.
Yeah.
And I was asking people on Twitter to come up with, giving me titles for songs that I would write against. And somebody put Office Goldfish. And I went, all right. And then I went home and I wrote it straight away and I recorded it, the whole thing. And I put it out on Twitter the next day. And everybody really liked it. So I tried to record it a few times, didn't really work, didn't want to put it on Uh-Oh for what, I can't remember why. But for album 2, I gave Tom Robinson all my demos on SoundCloud and said, can you just pick out some ones that really stick out for you? And that one was the one he said, you have to record that, it has to be a single. And said lots of other nice things that I won't repeat. But it was definitely one that I wanted to record. So it's basically about a goldfish in an office saying, kind of looking at the people in the office with a bit baffled about what the hell they're doing, and why they come in and go out every day, why they have sandwiches, why they, you know, come and kiss next to each other by the photocopier at Christmas parties, and just observing these people, not necessarily judging them, but just wondering what they're doing, you know, with their lives.
Yeah.
And which I think is an interesting perspective to take on a goldfish, because you wouldn't think, but then there's this Freudian, I think it's Freudian, or maybe it's Nietzschean, probably Nietzsche actually, about, you know, wild animals, or I think he was looking at a field of chickens in it, and he was going, well, they're more enlightened than we are. You know, they are, if you're trying to attain in the moment, the now, then the chickens have got it nailed and you haven't. So there's this kind of, I was reflecting on how more enlightened everybody, all animals are to us really, and sewed that into the Office Goldfish brief that I was given. And the video, which I've just finished, I finished it a few days ago, is going to be launched at the same time as the album. And it's me in a orange boiler suit leaping around an office.
Of course it is.
To my co-workers' horror when they saw the video.
All right, so donuts.
Donuts was something I found it on. I found the track on an old voice note. I wasn't happy with about three tracks on the album, which we'd already recorded with the Legend Society. And I was like, I don't know whether I like them. So I was going through my notes and I found the and I thought, I like that. And I had forgotten I'd written it. So I took it to Nick and went, what do you think? And he went, yep, let's do it. And we did it really quickly. The piano bits are played in that room there, which is where the Bohemian Rhapsody Bösendorfer grand piano is, which is pretty cool. Because all I'm doing is that. But yeah, it was done really, really quickly. I thought it captured the mood of the COVID moment of the time. Tom Robinson had uploaded a video of a load of passengers on a platform. He just slapped his phone on the window of a train, and I really, really liked it. And I said to him, "Can I use this for my video?" Because he said it opens up waiting in the morning for a train. Everything around me looks the same, and I just thought that'd be a really nice way to start it. And I think it was the first thing I'd recorded and released since I'd toured with him as well. So I thought it was a nice handover and just to show something that he'd done. And the rest of it was just looking for train track locally and filming it with my drone, because I had to do it. I don't mind doing it on my own anyway, but I filmed it with a drone. So that was
the... You're on the tracks at one point as well, aren't you?
Yeah, well, I'd found some bits that weren't being used anymore, but were quite new and were just not being used. So I basically asked a load of people. I think it was on Instagram. I'm not really sure. And I know quite a few sort of local photographers that know the area really well. And went, you should try this place and this place. And then Becky Wood gave me the best tips. I went out and filmed them. But I'm really happy with the track. I really like how the drums sound. It sounds very Ringo-y. The drummer Dustin Yem, who's in Kitten Pyramid now, is also in a Beatles tribute band as well, quite a successful one. So he can channel Ringo effortlessly, so it felt like Ringo was in the room, which is really cool. He knew every kind of little intonation that you would have on the drum kit, so that was really cool as well to have that on there.
Tell me about your dad.
He came along to the recording in this studio with his old band, because he'd been in a band since he was 15 called Fenimore, I think it was his first one. And he's still friends with the ones that are still around now. And they're in a band together still. And he's 69. So this is amazing. He's still mates with them. They're still playing, which is great. And he's still as excited about music as... And he sent me a track. He's done his first real kind of track on GarageBand today. So he's really getting into recording that way. Because he was using it like an 8-track, and I was going, you've got to see GarageBand, this will blow your mind. So I'm going to look forward to listening to that afterwards. But he brought his friends over to Rockville so they could see it, the place, and breathe it all in. And then I said, why don't we do the vocals for the same old, same old. So we did in that room there, in the live room. And that was really nice. It was really nice to see his old friends joining in. And singing with us.
I guess it dovetails quite nicely with 7 Day Duvet, because it's kind of got this kind of routine, this concept of routine and just wanting to like break out of it and take your clothes off, as you
said. I think so. I think I've got a, and I always worry about bringing this up, but I feel compelled to. I've got a very healthy awareness of my mortality.
Yeah.
And our mortality, if you like. And it means I can't take many things too seriously, because there's that. That's what I would class as an elephant in the room, really. And everyone can hear it but your auntie Mabel. She can hear the music when it starts, with all the complicated noises in her heart, following the colours that the manufacturer sounding like a baby.
Auntie Mabel?
Auntie Mabel was written ages ago, about a little old lady walking through Swaddling Coat, being surrounded by kind of, I like Mary Poppins, like cartoon characters of lions and tigers and bears, antelopes and crocodiles. And she's completely unaware of what's going on. And I didn't really know what all of that meant, but I wrote the lyrics years ago. In fact, it was the first track I opened with, or what we opened with when we did our album launch for Otto. And I said, right, before we get on to our debut album, here's a track from our second album. And I played this one. And I didn't really know what it meant, but it was one of those things that kind of revealed itself during COVID, really. And I was walking through Swad and I was looking at these little old people, and where everybody that's relatively young is glued to their phones and looking at the phones. They weren't, because they don't probably even have a phone, and if they do, there's nothing to look at because it's a Nokia or something. So they just kind of, they're blissfully unaware of tech, but at the same time I think the government was pushing out advice on how to download the app. And I just thought, well, they know, they're not gonna have to do that. They don't know what an app is. What are they gonna do? And just this kind of innate, I don't know, arrogance of young people. And I even at 50, I include myself in that when you compare it to elderly people. They've just, oh, well, just download an app. You know, I'll do it for grandma. Well, what if grandma hasn't got any family? It's scary enough a time as it is. Because I think when COVID really kicked in at the beginning, the older generation, the elderly, were like, oh, they were taking a kind of a keep calm and carry on post-war attitude of, we've got to soldier on, we've got to go out. You were seeing more old people going out shopping, I felt, than before. They were kind of showing this steadfast, diehard, you know, we'll be fine. And at the same time, everybody's going, you don't do that, you don't go out, you've got to cover yourself up, don't mix, don't talk, you've got to stay in. The opposite, you know, of what they'd been kind of trained for when they were kids. So I just thought, that's happening. And I got this track called Auntie Mabel, and I thought, Auntie Mabel is one of these people, and what if all of the animals that are around there are just us, the younger people with our phones and technology, and technology is an animal itself, and COVID obviously. So that all kind of made sense to me, really, in quite vividly. And then we decided, I was talking to some friends about what to do about the video. I'm always, if I can, I'd like to give money to charity if I can. And I thought, well, it'd be great to give whatever money we make from the track to the elderly. So we Googled Age UK, I think. And then on there, we found out Christopher Biggins had been an arts ambassador. So we just rang his agent up and said we'd like him to, and he was up for it, and he was in the video. So it all, that's what I mean. You couldn't storyboard that. There's no way on earth you could storyboard that. You have to listen, you know, listen to what's been, you know, happening around you and respond to that.
I showed my wife a video last night and she hadn't heard anything of Kitten Pyramid yet. And so I was like, let me show you this. And obviously for the first half, she's like, you know, like, what? It's just this fun, manic, like, you know, kind of indie rock thing. And then second half, just totally transforms. Yeah. And she
completely puts the brakes
she
on.
Was
yeah.
She was literally wiping tears, like, afterwards.
Really?
But she didn't know. Oh, wow. she didn't even know why.
Take her home and hang her up to dry.
I felt that too when I was editing it. when I got, there was a husband and wife by the market that was being taken down, and they were the sweetest couple. And I said to her, I said, I'm going to keep a distance. I got my GoPro. I'm going to keep a distance, but could you just bring your mask down so you can smile for me? And you just can see it in the film. It's just this, everybody goes, no understanding of why you feel that way. It was just a beautiful innocence and kindness that kind of shone out from both of their eyes. And then a deep, what's the word? Just feeling really sorry for them that we're having to go through such a traumatic time and not really knowing what the hell was going on. I mean, they weren't ancient, these people, but I don't know, they just gave me a nice smile. And I think when you capture that kind of stuff, your heart does melt, because it's the chicken in the now moment, you know. It's just capturing that and just being human.
I think she felt like Auntie Mabel had died or something as well.
Oh, God. End. Yeah, like... Oh, no, I didn't mean to say that.
the album seems to like juxtapose the absurd, the joyful, the hilarious with the painfully sad.
Yeah.
And do you think that having that level of humour in an album makes the poignant moments all the more powerful? Is that what your intent is?
Not really. I don't have any intent. I think not from that perspective. I want to write stuff that people will listen to and enjoy and be entertained by and not be bored. That's my intent. I think if it ticks those boxes, then whatever I write about in the middle of it doesn't really matter. I've got quite a... I don't know whether people read lyrics too much, but I want to be... I want to be accountable if they do. I want it to be able to stand up if they do. If it'll survive scrutiny.
Yeah.
Even if it on the surface does seem a little bit flippant. I don't know. I'm just listening to what I'm being told, really, and responding to it, as opposed to, I think it's important to have music that does have highs and lows and middle grounds and bigness. Just for, I call it a mixed diet, which is probably not a very good analogy, but it's got to have a mix. It can't all be, you know, I love, say, Joni Mitchell's Blue or Nick Drake's Five Leaves Left or Tom Waits's Closing Time, or which have quite a narrow range of...
Yeah.
Have a narrow range and extremely beautiful. And I'd die a happy man if I wrote any of those songs. But I think you can only do three or four of Five Leaves Left and you're like, okay, we need to go somewhere else now. And Closing Time, the same. I mean, I listen to Closing Time over and over and over and over again, so I can't really say that. But when I do stuff, I have to be entertained too. And if I get, but I listen to my album now, maybe my family go, oh, you listen to your album again. Yeah, I know. It seems really self-indulgent, but I do like the peaks and the troughs. And I think that, I do try, if I'm going to be serious, if I've got a serious subject to write about, like I did with Needles for my mum, then I know that's, because I'm right now, I'm feeling sad. So I know probably people are, you know, if I'm being sincere, they'll feel that too. And if I'm feeling silly, they'll probably feel that too as well. So it's just me being me, really.
I just wonder if there's an added, when someone you used to joking around gets serious, that perhaps has more weight than someone who's quite serious all the time, you know.
All the time.
I guess similar thing with like Neil Hannon does it. Very, very witty, very funny. But there's often like an emotional payoff of his music as well. And so when he's serious, it can be a little more sad, you know.
It's a difficult one, really, because I am a conscious of being daft. Because I am in life, I am daft. And I have to bring my down to a professional level often. And I've got quite a patient people I work with are quite patient with me, really, on that basis. But I think so long as I can create some serious stuff in there as well, that people do know I do have I think you're right, though. I think if you're really high and bright and big 1 minute and then you drink it down, you feel the contrast for sure, which is what your question is. Yeah.
Thank you.
Bounty, track six.
Bounty is a is I wrote that song about five different times and recorded it five different times. A real wrestle with that one, because I did consciously want to write a song that sounded and looked and sounded like that, because I didn't think there was one like that in the album, and I wanted to write one. I wanted to record one like that. And I was also talking to a lady called Joe Kendall, who...
From Prague.
And I was trying... I was asking her for some advice on something, and she said, look, I'm not going to be able to talk to you as quickly as I would normally do, because I'm not very well. And it turned out that she'd got cancer. And then... to cut a long story short, she then got the all clear, and she was really, really happy. And she sent me a text. She said, because I said, how are you? She said, I've just got the all clear, and I'm so pleased. I'm scoffing a bounty, and it was like the 36,000 beast moment. I went, yeah, well, that's a track, isn't it? I'm not going to have to argue with that, really. So I thought, well, I'll put the two together, and I actually, if you look at the lyrics, they are about her. And about, you know, going to the hospital and jumping into a tank of piranhas, which was my analogy for cancer, and all that kind of stuff, and red and green unseen, you know, not realizing she had it, and the terrors of that kind of stuff.
Why is scoff such a funny word?
I don't know. It's a beautiful English word, isn't it? Scoff. It is a great word, and I'm dead happy with it. She's dead happy with it, so it's nice to write songs that mean something for people as well.
I don't know. Well, we had some interaction on Twitter a few years, like maybe 3 years back, when I had this band and I was trying to get this album some attention, any attention, you know.
Yeah.
And we paid to be on the Prog Cover Mount CD.
Oh, cool!
It was like £100 or something. It was quite funny because we sent him this song that was like 10 minutes long, and they came back saying, oh, it's too long. It's like, it's a prog CD. It's a prog magazine CD. How can we be too long for a prog CD?
There's no such thing as a too long prog track.
Yeah.
I think Joe said something like, you just say, hold my beer when a guitar solo comes up.
But anyway, to be fair to them, they ended up sticking it on the CD because I think they had space. So that was nice.
Amazing. But
because we'd paid, as I saw it, there was like a flaw in the system. They were monetizing the CD to be able to, so like, I've paid to get my CD. So now you have to review my album, because you've said that our song is among the month's best prog. How can you have us on the CD but not review the album? And so I like pestered Joe on Twitter a bit. And to be fair, they got round it by sticking us in the sort of also ran like column.
Oh, okay, cool.
At the end, but we got a great review, even though it's only really small.
Oh, wow, cool.
So that was nice, but that's a
It's a difficult one, isn't it? That is, it's a difficult balance, because I've had some promotion. I like, there's in the Prog magazine this last issue, there's a half page advertising the album, and I spoke to Ollie, who's the salesperson for Prog, and I said about the Coverman CD, and I said it must be so difficult for you to. If people are paying to put their music onto that CD, but what if you don't like that track? What do you do then?
Yeah.
And also, even if you don't like, maybe you don't think it's a very good track, then you can't put it on, surely, because you, and I think music has took a huge beating by the likes of Spotify and YouTube and all that kind of stuff. But I also don't think it's guilt-free. I think we did ask for it a bit, and I'm collectively... And we did ask for it a bit, because I think if you can't wait to get an album done, just get it done, and you've got one good single and the rest are crap, and you release it, and that person spends in Woolies in the 1990s, $9.99, and all there is that one good track, and you have to wade through nine garbage tracks, then people are going to, you know, it's like having a McDonald's and your chips are made of sticks every time. You're just not going to buy a McDonald's anymore. So I think when music became free, people went, oh, thank goodness, because I don't have to. Now I'll just listen to that single. I won't listen to the rest of the album because I've been burned. And I have, and I'm sure you have.
$9.99. It was like $12.99 in the 90s. That's if you were lucky. Like, Beatles back catalogue albums are like $15.99 sometimes. And I remember like getting this terrible job in Spoils Kitchen Reject Shop. I mean, it wasn't a terrible, right. it was just a sales job. It wasn't a terrible job, but like I was getting paid $2.44 an hour, like, because I was 16. And I remember like the first paycheck going into Virgin and getting a 2-for-22 deal of the Flaming Lips Soft Bulletin and Big Calm by Mochiba. And feeling nice. Like, and feeling like 2-for-22 was like, you know, a reasonable. It was, oh, they've got a 2-for-22. I can get Big Calm by Mochiba and the Soft Bulletin by the Flaming Lips with my £2.44 an hour wage packet. Give me the keys, track 7.
I wrote that just before the Leisure Society agreed to record. So I was jamming around with the acoustics. The first part was written quite quickly. And I'm really, really, I'm the most proud of those lyrics than the whole album, really. The idea of being on a ship attacked by pirates trying to pull at your clothes, I just thought was a great analogy for social awkwardness. Because I'm quite gregarious, I don't know if that's the right word. I'm not too socially awkward, but you know, stick me in a nightclub or a room full of people that I don't know and I'm terrified. So I was trying to write about that really, and Give Me the Keys is basically saying, look, if you like being in this nightclub with all these strangers and you're comfortable and happy, cool, but I'm off, so give me the keys and you can stay here, which was where the rant comes from in the second section of the track, really. And I love the build up and the strings build up. I was really happy with. We got a room with 4 string players all 2 meter apart playing that. And I said to Nick, can I just try something with the players? And he went, yeah. So I went in and I went, can you just play from here to here as slowly as possible from this part of the song to that part of the song? And for the cello players, that was fine because I got loads of room. But for a violinist, it was like, well, I've only got this bit. And I went, just do it slowly. You'll be fine. And they did it, like, I think in 2 takes. And just listening to that creep in the studio was just, I went, oh, that sounds amazing. I love that sound. Day in the lifey kind of feel.
I was just about to say, because they had to do a similar thing, didn't they? I told to go here and end here. But like they found,
oh, did they?
I think so, yeah. But they found it quite difficult to sort of.
It is.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've worked with orchestral players much, but they are quite a difficult bunch to work with because I always find they just look at me like I'm a Fruit Loop, you know. Like the horn players on a track that's not on here, it was on a High Five Scuba Dive EP. And I mean, can you just play really just random notes, just squeal and just do strange things? And they went, what? And I went, just make noises. And they went, well, which noises and what notes? And I was like, I don't have any notes, just, you know. But they don't, they're a different breed. They're incredible, but they are a different breed to us. But with the string players, some of them went like, yeah, okay, I get it, that's cool. And I just did it. She's like a troll.
Control. So tell me about Troll, which is track 8.
I don't really know what Troll's about. I seem to be having a go at a husband and wife, but I don't know who it is, and I don't know why I'm having a go at them. But I was being quite judgy, really, about people just not being in the now and just being idiots, really, whilst I was trying to do what I was trying to do and trying to be enlightened. So, and I'm not enlightened, by the way, and it's a daily struggle to recenter, and I get sucked into daily dramas and rubbish all the time. But I think some people aren't even trying to pull out of that vacuum. They're just blissfully in it. And I think that's what Troll's about, is people that just don't have any awareness. They have no sense of mortality. They're just whinging about parking or something, you know? And I really have a tough time with those people, because, you know, a meteorite could hit us any second. So let's not worry about the minutiae. So that's what Troll's about, really. It's people, not online trolls, but maybe a little bit. I don't know. Maybe they're those kind of people. I can sit inside that category, but yeah, that's what it's about.
It was 1971, wasn't it? So that's 30 plus 15, so that's 45 years.
Really?
47 years, sorry. Yeah.
Whatever your age is, right? We've been married a year less.
Oh, okay. 43,
I think.
42. Hey, I'm not 44.
You could stop a train, pull along by planes and trees uproot and spin while cows try hard to swim. You loved to give your things, treat your friends like kings. They filled their cars and left high on cake and dresses made by hand at night.
So Needles, is that the song that's most about your mum?
Yeah, it's entirely about her. It's about her working as a nurse all her life, caring for people all her life. The nurses that she worked with would come and see her, because she was really, really handy. She was really, really crafty. She could make things, she could make wedding dresses and all that kind of stuff. And I felt at certain times they were taking advantage of her, because she'd work hard through her shift, and then you'd hear a sewing machine going up in the attic at night, desperate to hit a deadline, saving somebody's wedding dress. And then they'd all come in, they'd have coffee and cake and bundle a car full of stuff. And I was aware of that as a kid. But then when she became ill with MS, she had a brain tumor removed, and they found out she'd got MS and then epilepsy. She couldn't work anymore. She had lost her sight in one eye, so she couldn't do any of that stuff that she was amazing at, that you'd do more of when you retire.
Yeah.
And she'd had that all snatched away from her at a very early age, really. But they didn't really come in. Those people that she was kind of, that were leaning on her for stuff, didn't really, I didn't think they came and saw her enough and cared enough about her. They kind of left her. And my dad, they did, some of them did help and did come and see her, but I just felt like they could have done more. They could have been more of a friend, really.
Yeah.
So that's what I wrote it about, was that, you know.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry, mate. That's not nice.
Yeah, it is. It's awful. I think that when she managed to survive the battle of the tumour, but then to find she got MS, she couldn't walk, you know, near the end, the latter year, she was wheelchair bound. Mm. So she's just frustrated, but she would smile and she'd joke and all that kind of stuff. But she gave my dad a hard time. She'd had the rug of her life pulled on from her, and he was swept up in that. So it was very tough for them both. So I just, I mean, I did consciously, I hired a piano. I thought, I'm going to hire a piano, because I hadn't got a proper one. I'm going to hire a Yamaha for a couple of months to see what song plops out of it. And that one was the only one actually that survived and managed to make it to the album.
Yeah,
but I'm dead proud of it. I love the lyrics, and I like how I feel when I hear it.
Yeah,
I think it represents, and I think I played it her as well.
Oh wow,
I think I did.
Oh, that's nice.
And she really liked it. She was quite kind about when I played her. I played her some stuff off the EP, and she said it makes me feel really calm. Your music is really calming. Which I mean, I hadn't played the Daft stuff.
But has she heard it?
Yeah, well, she liked orchestral music. We very late in life realised, she never admitted to it. She said, "Oh, I really like classical music." And I went, "What? Really?" I said, "Well, you need to listen to this stuff because I've got tons of it on there." And she really liked it. So that was nice.
Yeah.
It was great to hear it.
He said, "Please wait. I've changed my mind. Don't steal the swans." No.
So appropriately, the closing song is called Swan Song. There's like a sample of someone talking at the start, isn't there?
That's at the beginning of Needles.
Sorry, is it? Okay.
No, it's all right. That's okay. She's talking about that. That was the amazing, the anti-storyboard movement of, she was talking about at the end about how, as part of her retirement, they went away, and when they went to the hotel, there was a swan made out of towels, and it blew her mind that they were able to do this. And I'd also written a song called Swan Song, which was about a load of guys in dinner jackets being told by their boss to steal a load of swans and stick them in the back of the van. I didn't really know why, but it was a little scene that I imagined when I drove over the bridge and looked down at the swans in Burton.
Huh.
So I just combine the two, really. I still call it Swan Song. It's quite a literal term. It was just the idea of, I suppose it's the biggest representation of how baffled I am by everything all the time. Why we're here, what we're here for, why we're doing what we're doing in the time we've got. And the idea of your boss telling you to pick a load of swans and stick them in the back of a van on a whim, and then when you finally achieve it, tells you to put them back out again, was a bit of a metaphor for our lives, really. It's all just a bit stupid. And so I thought, well, that makes sense for it to be at the end of this, after my mum, she's talking about swans anyway, and she's passed away, and then the swan song being this kind of, despite all that, everything's brilliant, and let's not be sad. Let's just crack on and enjoy it as much as we can and do what we can with the time we've got. So it's supposed to be, despite recognizing the banality of it all, it's also incredibly beautiful and we should celebrate it, which is how I feel about stuff. So it seemed a fitting end to the album.
Yeah. All right, final official question. Have you ever had a dream filmed in Super 8?
One of my dreams? What do you mean? Is that a lyric?
No, have you ever dreamed in Super 8?
No, I don't think I have. Where's that? What's that from? Where'd you get that from?
Don't know. It's just an idea. I've stuck it into my own songs a couple of times because I like the image that someone might have a dream filmed in Super 8.
Oh, a dream filmed in Super 8. Oh, I see what you mean. I don't know whether you'd want to see my dreams in Super 8. they can be very, very disturbing.
Really?
They can be. Very symbolic a lot of the time. I know what yours are like, but
I don't know if this is a rude question, but obviously I know your uncle had schizophrenia. Is that on your dad's side or your mum's side?
It's my mum's side. My mum and my uncle came across with their mother, my nanny, from Poland. Over in the late 50s. Well, my mum came over in 1950, probably, actually. No, that's not right, because she was 14, so it'd been later, in the 60s, sorry. So that whole line, because my nan was she was strange at times as well. So there's a line of genetics from that gene pool.
This is what I wanted to ask. Are you kind of ever worried about yourself, I guess, like not Yeah, does it worry you to discover stuff like that?
It's a great question, actually. I think if you were able to separate what goes on in my head, then you probably wouldn't ask that question, because you'd see the chaos and the noise and the paranoia and the colour and everything else. But I somehow, and maybe it's my dad's stronger genes, somehow they managed to put a wall around it, and I've got a little tap that's connected to that wall, and I'm able to turn it on, make a few tracks, and then turn it off again. And so I do tap into the, I don't want to use the word madness, because that's kind of a dirty and a disrespectful word, but the surrealism and the abstractness of mental illness, I do believe is flowing through my veins. I'm just able to contain it somehow. I don't, I have low times. I'll have a bad day where I'm just a bit low, but I'm able to pull out of it quite quickly. My son struggles with it quite badly, actually, especially when he was in his late teens, early 20s, really struggled. He's more centered now because he's got twins and a thing to focus on, but he had a tough time with it. I really felt for him, because there was this thing about it skips a generation.
Right.
And I went, oh, well, I'm all right then. That's fine. And then realizing, well, I might have kids. You know, what does that mean? And I think my son really, really has a tough time with it. My daughters seem pretty cool.
Yeah.
They have their moments, but yeah, not to the severity. I mean, he was a paranoid schizophrenic, which I think that also is a disrespectful way of terming it, but that's what it was called in the 80s.
Yeah.
So he I'd sit with him and he would be staring into the abyss, and I'd try and talk to him, and then he'd zero in and look at me, and he would say something about cement or something very surreal. But I never felt afraid when it was with him, and people said I should have been, because, you know, paranoid schizophrenics were portrayed wrongly, that they're dangerous, and I always think that they're a little bit like spiders, really. They're more afraid of you than you are of them, or that you should be. So yeah, no, I'm cool, I'm good. I think without art I would be a different person, probably. I think I'm able to channel, because I think stuff does have to come out of that wall and be channeled somewhere, and I put it into art.
That's our show. Scott and I wanted to give a shout out to the Samaritans over here in the UK. They have a free phone number manned 24 hours a day, 365 days a week for anyone in need of help. Visit samaritans.org for more information. Thanks as always to our guests whose opinions are their own. Thanks also this episode to Ben Pester, Sally Craddock and Gabby Green. Back in 2 weeks with David Brewis of Field Music and more.